My name is Tova Kelman Gutenberg, and on behalf of my family, we are honored to welcome everyone here tonight in such large numbers. A tribute both to my parents and to our distinguished guest speaker. We would like to thank the BATE, and in particular Elaine Genisoff and her co-chair Michelle Jacobs, for helping to organize tonight's program. Rabbi Karofkin sends his regrets as he is involved in another program tonight and could not join us. Next Monday, this coming Monday, our family will mark the 19th yahrzeit of our mother, Ruth Kelman, Rachel Bat Chaim, Zichrona Livracha, and the following Monday will be the 9th yahrzeit of our father, Rabbi Joseph Kelman, Harav Chaim Yosef Ben Harav Tzvi Yehuda, Zichrona Livracha. The commandment to honor one's parents does not end with their deaths, but continues on. One of the ways we do so is by striving to live our lives in a way that upholds the values and lessons they taught us, and in passing those values on to following generations. Our father was the 8th generation of rabbi in his family, son after son, and to him it was a labor of love to serve his shul and his wider community. Both my brothers and our 2 sons have followed in his footsteps, all of them obtaining smicha at my father's alma mater, Yeshiva University. My mother became a rebbetzin at the tender age of 20 and continued thereafter to devote herself to her family, various shuls. They started their married life in Sherbrooke, Quebec, so my mother could finish her BA. They moved on to Suffern, New York, where I was born, and then we returned to Canada when I was a little girl, where my 2 brothers joined us later on. She devoted herself to her family, shul, and community. My parents had a wonderful partnership of a marriage for 45 years and were an incredible team. My father's creativity and spontaneity balanced by my mother's perception, common sense, and insight. Their commitment to family and acts of chesed were and continue to be inspiring. It was our parents' wish that we commemorate their yahrzeits through learning, and we are very honored to have with us tonight Dr. Carl Skorecki, who knew my parents. My father followed Dr. Skorecki's career closely and with pride. Dr. Skorecki's bio is lengthy, but I will just highlight a few things in keeping with the Talmudic dictum, Miktzat Shvacho Lefanav, only say a little bit of praise in front of him. Dr. Skorecki was born and raised in Toronto, attending Associated Hebrew Day School in Chat, and graduated medicine in 1977 from the University of Toronto as the gold medalist. Following postgraduate studies in Boston, he returned to Toronto in 1984, serving as director of nephrology and professor in medicine, before making Aliyah with his family in 1995. He joined the Technion's Faculty of Medicine in Haifa in the Rambam Medical Center, where he currently serves as Director of Medical Research Development. His current major research interests are in human population and molecular genetics. Previous research has traced founding patrilineal and matrilineal lineages in Near East and Jewish populations. His research results have been reported in leading scientific and medical journals, and he has received research prizes as well as university and international teaching awards. Dr. Skorecki and his wife Linda are the proud parents of 5 children, 5 in-law children, and 17 grandchildren, all of whom remarkably live in or close to Haifa. At this time, it gives me great pleasure to call on Dr. Carl Skorecki, who will be talking about the genetic history and future of the Jewish people.
Thank you, Shalom, Erev Tov. It's hard. Thank you so much for a really very, very generous introduction. There's so many reasons for me to be emotional and my voice break up. And I thank, first of all, everybody for coming, and I'm very, very grateful for the honor of being able to speak to very close friends, people almost all of whom I know and influenced me over the years of my youth and growing up, and our family, to commemorate the memory of Rabbi and Rabbanit Kelman, whom, as Tova mentioned, I knew personally very well. And I'll say a word or two about that. It's really a very, very special honor and privilege, and also to see so many friends. And I really thank you very much for coming. I know it's to honor the Kelmans, but I will also take it as in a great appreciation. I'd like to have a slide. The first slide is a picture with the dates, if I could just get some help with that, because I want to say a few words. I could speak a lot about, and I thank the Kelman and Gutenberg family for honoring me this way. So the connection, many connections with Rabbi and Rabbanit Kelman, so I can't really talk about all of them, but I'll just mention a couple. One of the main connections, I'm only child of Holocaust survivors, and my adopted siblings were the Fields family. Many of them are sitting here. Hi, Lally and Max. I didn't see you earlier. And basically, they became my brothers because I spent a lot of time there. And of course, they're neighbors of Rabbi Kelman, Rabbanit Kelman. And that's how we became very close. And I'm just going to say two things, but there's hundreds of things that could be said, and the influence on the Jewish community and the community in general, and then through the generations. One is the following. Many families in Toronto, but the Fields family and my parents were Holocaust survivors, and, you know, the terms, I don't know if they're such nice terms, Heegers and Greeners. I don't know if anyone knows about that, but when... So we were Greeners, and our parents spoke with a thick European accent and didn't always feel 100% at home. But there were some people and rabbinical leaders who were very sensitive to that. And Rabbi Kelman and Rabbanit Kelman were, in that respect, stars. They were so welcoming. They just hugged us and made us feel like, yes, yes, you're here. You belong with the community. And that was very, very important to that generation and our parents. And I think about it a lot, because not everyone was like that. Many were, but they were the most excellent. And you know, just their neighbors, they were neighbors. They were my neighbors too, because I spent half my life on Evanston. So the whole Bathurst Manor Shepherd community. Another just event, I was in the Beth Emeth Synagogue. It may have been Dr. Louis Fields' bar mitzvah. By the way, I'm going to talk about something which many of you have heard already and could probably give this talk, Dr. Fields, Dr. Seiza, and many of you have heard it. But I'll try to put a little few twists in. But I just want to say something that Dr. Fields and I are both young, but we're even younger then. And I'm a little tiny bit younger than Louis. And it may have been as a bar mitzvah. I'm not sure. I was in the Beth Emeth Synagogue, and Rabbi Kelman called me, I couldn't believe this was happening, to hold the Torah on the stage, you know, during the Haftorah. And I'm this little kid, and I was sitting there. I felt like Moses going up to Sinai. I had never held, and I was in the middle of sort of a spiritual, more observant awakening. That was a moment of inculcation of deep faith. I sat there for about 15 or 20 minutes, a little kid, holding a Sefer Torah up on the stage of the Beth Emeth Synagogue, and it turned me in a very, very powerful spiritual way that sits with me to this day. And it was Rabbi Kelman who had that insight somehow and made that big difference. So I could tell many stories about it, and therefore it's very, very meaningful for me to be here today. So I'm sure I'm not doing justice to the many, many, many great things that this wonderful couple did and continue to do through their memory and through their wonderful children and future generations. So as was mentioned, I'm going to try to talk about, in the past, I never had the word future, right? I used to have, those of you who may have heard, genetic history of the Jewish people. This is not my main, I'm a nephrologist, you know, kidney specialist. But this became a hobby when I go places and I want to talk about kidneys. Everyone says, no, don't talk about that. Talk about the Kohanim and all that stuff. It's kind of a hobby. So, sorry about that. And say a word about... So I'm going to pose some questions. Some of them sound like they're a little provocative, and they are. They're meant to be. Is there a Jewish people? we say Jewish people, history of Jewish people. Is there a Jewish people? What is it? Can we learn about history from DNA? I'm going to talk about DNA. What can we learn about the past history of Jews from DNA of contemporary Jews? And from this work, this is rhetorical, are there implications to health, law, society, halacha, and so forth? So I'll try to touch on these. I'll try not to get into too much detail, and I'll try to leave some time for questions, although it's kind of a lot of material. And then, you know, the famous movie Back to the Future, let's see if we can see something that, you know, looking ahead. I want to really get provocative by presenting two cases, and we may not get back to them, or we may get back to them. So they're kind of modified from real cases. Just, they're not even names here, but maybe the ages are changed too. A 30-year-old Israeli woman is to marry an Israeli Jewish man in Israel. The woman immigrated at age 12 from the Ukraine under the law of return. So the Israeli law of return, many of you are familiar with it. Remarkably and frighteningly almost, they follow the same laws as the Nuremberg laws. There is, whoever would have been persecuted in Europe has a refuge in Israel. There is documentation for Jewish identity for paternal grandfather, but no comparable record on her maternal side. The rabbinical courts in Israel don't grant her a marriage permit. This is always a difficult issue, as we know. She carries out private DNA testing, which shows that she has mitochondrial, and we'll explain that in a minute, maternally transmitted DNA of a certain lineage. The numbers don't, it's called K1A, 1B1A, which is shared with 1.5 million people who are clearly identified as Jewish, while this particular lineage was only found in one non-Jew, probably actually didn't realize that they were Jewish. That is, it's very distinctly different, this set of markers, in a sample set of more than 13,000 non-Jews. So the question is, does she need conversion at all or not? Or can we just say, look, she's born Jewish, period. Whether she doesn't maybe know it. I'll come back to that, maybe, if there's time. A second, there's hundreds of cases like this I get all the time. Of course, I always tell people, I'm not a Rav, go to the Rav, right? But then the Rav calls me and says, well, what does this mean? So so then there's, second case was really kind of interesting. A 26-year-old religiously observant Kohen, call him AA, was introduced to a 22-year-old daughter, BB, of another Kohen, CC, who had married a divorcee, rendering the daughter halachically what's called a halala and unable to be married under traditional halachic rules to AA, right? So AA asked me, called me, really called me, and I said, look, I'm not a rabbi, we don't do individual testing, I do research, don't, you know, et cetera. He said, no, just hear me out. If the Y chromosome markers, which are, as I'll show you in a minute, inherited in the male line, show that I come from a lineage different than that of the man, the father of this girl, this young woman who I want to marry, then either neither of us are Kohanim. If I am, he's not. If he is, I'm not. So we should be able to get married. I said, I don't know, speak to the Rav, but scientifically, that is correct. And so that is a question of, you know, what some of the very difficult implications and the heavy burden of doing this kind of research can be. All right? So, yes, what should I do? I actually can't see me. Okay. Oh, that's better. I can walk around and do a TED-type talk instead, right? And I have to make sure all my buttons are done up. Everything's okay, because now you can see everything. I'm exposed. All right. You know, I can take the microphone even. How's that? Why don't I do that? Okay? I can step down and do all that stuff, okay? I can do a dance. I can't sing. I have a terrible voice. So is there a Jewish people? I mean, why ask? Well, I'm asking because there's this book by a professor of French theater at Tel Aviv University who only wrote the book after he got tenure. And he wrote it at first in Hebrew, and then it was translated into English and became a bestseller called The Invention of the Jewish People. All right, and I don't really recommend the book, but I star prominently in that book. He has a whole lot about me and accuses me of doing research as a Zionist agent, basically. So I would suggest that instead you read first, if at all, you know, the Hillel Halkin, who's also a great author, review of this book, okay, and then decide if you want to actually read the book. But it is a bestseller among many of those detractors of the Jewish people. But the real clue came when Shlomo Sand, by the way, he could have called me. I'm really accessible. And he could have just spoken to me. He never spoke to me. He just wrote stuff. And then he wrote a book, How I Stopped Being a Jew, right? So, and kind of says what's going on behind him. If I think it's extremely important to read, not just, you know, do DNA testing and genetics, to couple it. And we work closely with historians. And the great late Martin Gilbert, the biographer, of course, of Churchill, who wrote a great history, an atlas of the Jewish history. Tudor Parfit, who used to be at the School of Oriental African Studies, very interested in African relations to the Jewish people, we work closely with. Sergio della Bergola is probably the world's greatest expert on demographics of the Jewish people. Shai Cohen and Stephen Weitzman, I don't always agree with what they say, but they're very, very thoughtful scholars. And these are books they read. And I think Origin of the Jews is very, very recent. These are books that are highly scholarly and not agenda-driven for the most part, which I'll get to. And there are many others. So let's get to the next point. I'll come back to that. Can we learn more generally about human history from DNA? I think, you know, our work started this ball rolling many years ago now, 1995 or six. But it's led to a whole lot of insight about using DNA as an adjunct tool, together with other tools like linguistics, like archaeology, and shows us, and I like to do this summary slide at the beginning because the talk can drone on and people will kind of fall asleep and they get bored. So this way, you get the punchline at the beginning and then the rest, it's okay if you, you know, just play with, you don't play with your iPhone, but you can think about other stuff, okay? So DNA marker evidence indicates that all humans are part of one extended family. And using that same kind of DNA marker evidence, we can see very clearly that Jewish people scattered across many diaspora communities are members of a branch of this extended family originating in the Near East around 3,000 years ago. But it is more complicated, okay? And we'll get to the complexity. Now, DNA, of course, everyone just, you know, it's used a lot. The DNA of, you know, it implies what's inherent in somebody. And it has really advanced biological science, it's medical genetics, and this whole field called genetic archaeology, which has anthropology, where you look at human origins, population genetics, to look at communities and demographics, and a whole industry of genetic genealogy. I'm sure some of you have tested yourselves at Family Tree DNA or 23andMe, or there are many companies have done well. I'll tell you a little story. When we first published our paper on the Kohanim, a businessman came to me and said, you know, we should start a company. This is really good. And I'm not, people know me, I'm terrible with I have no business head at all. And I remember saying to them, and he quotes me, this is Bennett Greenspan and Max Blankfield, founders of Family Tree DNA. I said to them, no one in their right mind would pay money to get a direct-to-consumer DNA test. They have made tens of millions of dollars, okay? And I talk about it. and I don't regret it for a second. And I'm good friends. And one of my students, who I'll show you, is involved in that, and I'm proud of him. If we're talking about history, those of you who've heard me in the past, I try not to miss the opportunity to mention a very great omission in the history of science, and that is the, and it's been corrected recently, but very recently, the real discovery of the double helix structure of DNA, which we'll see in a minute. Who did the experiment? It wasn't Watson and it wasn't Crick, because if you ask most high school students or grade school students, or watch NCIS, you know, they'll say Watson and Crick. But it was Rosalind Franklin, a woman, Jewish woman in London, who did this experiment, which is an X-ray diffraction, and her head of department took, without asking her, I mean, this shouldn't be done, took this picture and showed it to Watson and Crick without her knowing, and they deduced the double helical structure. If you read Watson's book, it doesn't quite say it that way, but if you read Brenda Maddox's book recently, she gets it right, and it's important. Of course, Rosalind Franklin, I'll get back to that, succumbed at a young age before the Nobel Prize was awarded to a disease that's related to genetics, which we'll get to. And of course, the double helical structure is well known, and it enables this remarkable property of inheritance. That is, the DNA strands can separate and replicate themselves. And we know that if DNA replication were precise, no errors, like a Xerox machine, if there are such things anymore, we would have a boring world full of identical copies of the same sequence. That's what the world would look like. So we wouldn't be standing here talking and enjoying diversity. But inherent in DNA replication are errors and ability to fix the errors, but they're not perfectly fixed. And that is the basis for the richness of living diversity. And that's why the world is so beautiful. But there is a price paid, and that price is sometimes illness. And that's why we are enjoined by the Torah, Virapo Yirape, double, and you shall surely heal. So we are partners in that, and I'm from Rambam. I have to put a plug in for Rambam Medical Center, too. It was mentioned. So that's what we do. Of course, also University Health Network and North York General. I passed Branson. It had changed. When I left, it was a hospital. Now it's the Ambulatory Center for North York General, right? Something. So things change. Now, these changes in DNA are mostly completely silent. They don't cause any difference that we can discern unless you actually sequence the DNA. They don't make us look different, talk different, or anything, most of them. But some do, and we can see them all if we look for them by sequencing DNA. Now, there are medical students and doctors and scientists here, and I apologize for kind of really oversimplifying stuff. Then they're called markers. The most useful ones are the ones that don't cause any changes because they follow what's called neutral patterns of inheritance. They just happen, and then if that person happened to has children, they're passed on, and they're not under any favorable or unfavorable influence. And these are the markers that we use in population genetics to trace ancestries and to map real disease-causing mutations. So we can use them to map something that really causes a change. So when you take these markers together, you can build a tree. And one kind of marker, which I sometimes describe, but I decided I wouldn't this time, is just called a single nucleotide polymorphism. Short form, the acronym is SNP, which is just a one-letter change. An A becomes a G or something, and it doesn't change anything in the meaning of the code, of the 3-billion-letter code. But you can see it, and then if it occurs in a lot of people, because it happened in somebody and that person had many progeny, et cetera, and a certain percentage of the population has it, then it defines a branch. And you can take a bunch of them because they're spread all over the 3 billion letters of the genome, and you can have a tree with lots and lots of branches. And when you have a bunch of these SNPs together, and I didn't write this here, it'll come up later, it's called a haplotype. There's another kind of marker, again, I won't describe it in detail, but it is an area of DNA where the letters, remember the 3 billion letters, a four-letter alphabet, A, C, G, and T, repeat themselves. So you could have an area which repeats G, A, G, A, C, A, C, A, G, A, T, A, 10 times in me, 12 times in you, 15 times in you, 14 times in Dr. Says, and 19 times in Dr. Fink, or something like that, at that same spot. And you can then use these as well, but they mark very recent fine events. So they are like twigs on a branch. And then when you take a twig on a branch, then you get what's called a lineage. A twig on a branch, then you get a lineage. Okay. Now, where are these? Where are all these? You know, here I am. Are they written here? Where are they? Okay, so everyone knows they're in our DNA, and the DNA is in every cell of the body except for red blood cells. And they're in two places. The bulk are in the nucleus of the cell on 23 sets of chromosomes. And this is a karyotype, 23 sets of chromosomes of a male. Why do we know it's a male cell? Because it's X and Y, okay, X, Y. Pair from mother and father, one. Pair of mother and father, two. And X from mother, Y from father. If it were a female, it would be X from mother and X from father as well. Okay, that's one place, all these letters. That's where most of them are. There's another place, so that's a male. And the markers on the Y chromosome then trace a paternal lineage, okay? Good. Now, DNA is also outside of the nucleus. There's a little bit of DNA in all cells, in a little organelle in the cell called the mitochondria. They probably came into cells from bacteria, but we won't go into that. And what's interesting about mitochondria is everyone in the room has mitochondria and mitochondrial DNA, men and women, but only women can transmit that mitochondrial DNA to their sons and daughters. Men cannot do it because the egg eats up the mitochondrial DNA from the male, destroys it completely, and all that's left is the mother's mitochondrial DNA. Okay, that's what's left. So the mitochondrial DNA markers trace maternal ancestry exclusively. So now we can see, we have tools to reconstruct ancestry. Individuals who share the same set of markers, what I called earlier a haplotype, it's just a fancy word for a group of markers, at a given genomic region, let's say in the Y chromosome, right? They must share common ancestry, male in this case, at that genomic region. So the markers on the Y chromosome share paternal ancestry. So if I set a markers and haplotypes which are very similar to another man in the room, we share recent paternal ancestry. If the markers are on mitochondrial DNA, they're there. If I check them, I can check them wherever I want. I check them on mitochondrial DNA, that means we share maternal ancestry. This can be done in men and women, of course. Y chromosome ancestry can only be checked in men because only men have it. All right, so how did it begin? It didn't actually begin with Leonard Nimoy, but I'd like to show his picture. I'll show you where it began. It began right here in BAYT, okay? And I'll show you a picture to prove it. No pictures were taken on Shabbat, don't worry, but I'll show you, okay? So many of us were Star Trek fans, and we have a biblical tradition. It's based on this pasuk in this verse in Shemot, right? About starting a paternal dynasty. And if you really are a Trekkie fan and you really want to see, I go into this website. I can send you this presentation, no problem. You can go into this website, click on it, and you'll see one of the last interviews of the late great Leonard Nimoy before he passed away, where, if you've seen it, he explains how he thought of the Vulcan salute, okay? I'll tell you, but it relates to his being a little kid and peeking and seeing the hand motion of the Kohanim, how he did it because the hands are covered. His father told him not to look. So obviously, he looked. And then he somehow recalled that. This is what he says. And told the director, you know, the director said, you better do something because you're from another planet. He said, I know exactly what to do. And that's, so more people know about this hand motion from Star Trek than they do from going to shul, that's for sure. Okay, so now here is what really happened, okay? And the credit goes to someone you may know, Stephen Greif, okay? So one day I was upstairs, okay, in this shul right here. And this was shortly before we moved to Israel. And we had already lived on Peru, but for some reason I was back here at a simcha or something. And this man, back then, got the Kohen Aliyah. Now, you know, some people, Kohanim don't get too bent out of shape when they don't get an Aliyah, right? Because we often get a Aliyah, you know? Other people really, I think it's great when people get upset when they don't get an Aliyah, because if that is what you're interested in that honor, that's a great thing. You want to be called to the Torah, you know? Now, if you get all angry and broges for the next 20 years, that's not good, but if you want to go and get an Aliyah, I think that's great. Kohanim don't really have that, so this man, Itamar Cohen, who many of you may know, okay, you probably know him, I didn't know who he was, but he got an Aliyah, and I looked at him, and I said, well, you know, he doesn't really look like he has the same paternal ancestor as I do exactly. What's he doing getting an Aliyah as a Kohen, right? And I was sitting there, sitting beside me was Dr. Howard Goldberg. And I said, you know what? We could check this. You know, there are tools to check this. And that was on Shabbat, okay? I should have been davening, but I was or listening to the Torah reading. And then Monday, okay? Because, you know, in Israel it would have been Sunday, right? But Monday, I go to the lab and I got all excited about it, and that's how it started. Now, where is this picture taken? So Stephen Greif said, I know the Kohen who you talk about when you give these talks and you write about and et cetera. I said, oh, you can't possibly know who this person is. Yes. Because at that time, there was really only one non-Ashkenazi Kohen and this and that, and he's the only one who could have gotten the Aliyah, this and that. I said, send me a picture of what he looked like back then. And then, as many of you know, he moved to Israel, and I know him now and his family. I invited him, called him, he came. This is in the courtyard of Rambam, the old monastery building of Rambam. And we took pictures together, and we stayed in touch ever since. So that led to this hypothesis. I think that's the first time I've shown that. I have his permission, by the way, okay? I wouldn't do that without his permission. So the hypothesis is that the Y chromosomes of historically and geographically dispersed Kohanim should be more alike than the Y chromosomes of a random group of men and more alike than other parts of their genome, right? Their mitochondrial DNA, chromosome 1, chromosome 7. Now, I'd like to explain this, although it's pretty clear. I'll make 2 points. Like if someone were to tell their son, okay, a secret word and write it on a piece of paper, put it in a safe, lock it away, and tell their son, because this is the Y chromosome, to only reveal that secret word to their male descendants, to their sons, and so on and so forth. Fast forward 100 generations, which I think, you know, medical progress, it might be able to live to see it in the future. Open the safe and then take, you know, 10,000 men who don't know the word and 10,000 men who do know the word. If that tradition was kept, then the men who know the word should have markers on their Y chromosome more alike statistically than those who don't know the word, random group of men. So this is going backwards, and that was the hypothesis. Now, I'm going to take a moment here and say a word. This coming week, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks is going to get an honorary doctorate at the Technion, and we're going to have a debate. He is going to debate against Aaron Shechanover, Nobel laureate with Avram Hershko, on questions of science and religion, science and faith, and I get to moderate that debate. So that's going to be, I think, really interesting in terms of science and faith. Okay, but in science, I think it's important to be able to say, I'm testing a hypothesis, and I'm prepared to refute it. Otherwise, you're not a scientist. You're practicing religious faith, which is fine. Okay, it's perfect. And we're ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. And our belief is based on emunah. We can do science. The Rambam said, fine, do science, study. We're the chachamim, observed. The chazal, Talmud, is full of observations. But when you're doing science, you have to be prepared to refute. Otherwise, you shouldn't be doing it. Shlomo Sen and those guys, they have an agenda, not really doing scholarly work, I think. So what did we do? I'm going to summarize it. We checked a bunch of markers. At the beginning, there were only a few. Now there are, if you go to Family Tree DNA or any of these, and you can sequence the whole Y chromosome, there are hundreds of lineages. And the question is, will Kohanim, people who self-identify, be dispersed randomly among the lineages, or will they be clustered? That's really the question. And I want to emphasize this. There isn't a test. I get every day, I get 3 or 4 emails. Can you test me? There is no test. There is no test. Until we have the DNA of Aaron, biblical Aaron, we won't really know, or a bona fide, clear descendant of Aaron. And that may come. And what we found was, and this is important because I'm often misquoted on this, a remarkably limited number of Y chromosome lineages are shared among Kohanim from temporally and geographically dispersed diaspora communities. It's not one. There are four or five, not hundreds or thousands as you'd expect. The largest, which covers about 50%, coalesces to 3,200 years ago. That does not mean that was biblical Aaron's Y chromosome. It just happens to coalesce there. It might be. We don't know. And it got a name called the Cohen modal haplotype. Modal means it's the most common. And companies then sell this to you and say, this is it, you know, but it really is just a bunch of statistics. That's all it is. And this has been consistent over more than 23 years now of research and has spawned a bunch of companies, as I mentioned. But to me, this was not too exciting because it makes sense. You know, this is just testing a hypothesis. Also, wasn't surprising that there wasn't just one because we have many, many instances in, and there are Rabbanim here, of course, who can speak to this much more intelligently than I can, of entry into the kahuna during the Second Temple period, people purchasing the kahuna and so forth. So I was actually surprised there were so few. I would expect many more, non-paternity, rape shaloneda, all these things, right? So how could, you know, I was a little bit, but I didn't think that anyone would pay any attention. I thought this was very parochial, you know, of interest to maybe four people. It got a lot of attention. To me, what was interesting was something else. Not that there were so few lineages, but rather that the pattern of these lineages was conserved and the same among geographically dispersed diaspora communities. The same sets in Djerba, in Lithuania, in Iraq. So how could that be? I said, well, how could that be? I mean, what, do they trade DNA? Or what do they, how did that happen? That means they must have been together at some time. They originate in a common pool. Otherwise, how could they have arisen, you know, separately over so many years being apart? And that brings us to the rest of the story, which to me is more interesting than this Y chromosome Kohanim stuff, which I, you know, is the intro, basically. So I'd like to show this as the first and most striking example. It remains, in my mind, the most striking example. So this is Ephraim from the Lemba tribe in northern South Africa, mostly in Zimbabwe, a little bit in Mozambique. Okay. And I still have that sweater, and I'm not wearing my blue shirt, but that was me. Okay. And the Lemba have an oral tradition. It's not written anywhere. They have no archive. That Buba, a leader, led a group of men and women out of the ancient kingdom of Judea to settle in the Hadramut, Yemen. Adim is a sort of scientific name for a population group. And then for reasons unclear, not that long ago, a boat load of Jewish men from that community sailed from Yemen to southern Africa, went inland and married local Bantu-speaking women, okay, because there were no women that they brought with them from Sena or from Judea. And they did their best not to let other men enter into the community. Tudor Parfit, who I mentioned, who we work with, went there, collected DNA. We worked together with Neil Bradman, David Goldstein, and many, many others. Analyzed, and we found something I think very remarkable, that the Y chromosome signatures, these markers that I keep talking about, of many, well over 60 or 70% of Lemba are very similar to those of Kohanim especially, other non-Kohanim Jews as well. They look Near East paternally. The rest of their genomes look like they're Bantu-speaking African neighbors. You can tell from their skin color. You can tell from everything. But the Y chromosome keeps getting passed down, and you can't tell that we're related, me and Ephraim, by looking at us. I don't think you'd guess that we're related, but we share recent paternal ancestry. So we're related in a certain sense, okay? So we couldn't have guessed that. You have to actually check the Y chromosome. But I want to draw an important distinction between relatedness, genealogic, and genetic. So we don't share lots of DNA together. Let's say we might not respond to the same drug in the same way. We have a different appearance. But we are genealogically related, not necessarily genetically related, because we had very different histories over the wanderings of my ancestors and the wanderings of his ancestors in terms of introgression and admixture with others. And each genomic region has its own evolutionary history. The Y chromosome is what we check if you're looking for paternal ancestry. Ashkenazi Jews, they get a disproportionate amount of attention. And a question arises, are they a lost tribe? Okay, I'm part of them, so are we a lost tribe? Am I part of a lost tribe? So what is taught in the history books about where European Jewry came from, right? What's taught in history books, turns out to be correct, is that it is the result of Jews in the Roman Empire period, augmented by the exile, the Second Temple destruction, a community in southern Italy, migration up the Rhine Valley, Speyer, places where Rashi was, etc. Many expulsions, and then King Kazimierz of Poland allowing the Jews to move into Poland, and then a massive expansion. And that's kind of the rough history. Now, I'm going to say a word, of course, about the Spanish exile. And then this question mark comes up all the time. Well, maybe this is all not true. Maybe this is a fiction, a Zionist fiction, a colonialist fiction. And many of you know this question of a West Eurasian origin, the Khazar origin. Now, where did this come from, and what does it mean, and what's going on? Okay, so it actually started before Arthur Kessler. Many of you know Arthur Kessler was a well-known philosopher. He was strongly anti-communist. He wrote Darkness at Noon and other books. The last book he wrote before he passed away, he was a Hungarian Jew, was The 13th Tribe. And he says explicitly why he wrote this book, okay? So he uses very vague kind of evidence saying, look, the Ashkenazi Jews have nothing to do with the biblical Israelites, nothing. They are descendants of West Eurasians, a Khazar kingdom. That's who they are. They're descendants of the Khazar kingdom. He writes it in this book. And it's a very romantic story, isn't it? And he had an agenda. So this is what I'm saying about doing agenda-driven research and doing hypothesis-testing research. You have to be very careful. There are agendas which are important to promote. Health. Health is an agenda which is important to promote. Humility is an agenda which is important to promote. He had an agenda which was kind of misguided. He somehow didn't realize there were non-Ashkenazi Jews, and he said, I'm going to solve the problem of European anti-Semitism. I'm going to, you know, it mostly has a Christian origin related to the sin of the Israelites. And he said, well, you know, the Jews of Europe have nothing to do with that. You don't have to hate them. You know, the church doesn't have to hate the Jews because these are not the descendants of those that cursed people. They are the descendants of people like you. So that was his kind of motivation. Had nothing to do really with science or scholarship. It had to do with he had something good in mind, but it backfired. It backfired very badly. Sorry. And is the basis, it's what Shlomo Sand writes about. It's what many people have written about now to break any relationship between European Jews, the Zionist movement, which is Europe and other parts of the world as well, and the modern state of Israel. Now, I want to say, I'll just say something that's going to sound really odd, I think. It wouldn't matter one iota to me if we were the descendants of Khazar. It doesn't matter, because the Eretz Yisrael living as a person of faith is a religious injunction. It has to do with my religious faith, not my peoplehood affiliation. It happens to be that this is all wrong. I think I may have a slide of that. I tended, when books like Shlomo said, to not be interviewed in the press, I don't like arguing non-science in the press, until a paper came out in a scientific journal purporting to show that the DNA markers of European Jews are unrelated to Near East peoples. It's an Israeli scientist at University of Sheffield. It turns out a lot of this work is funded by some of our detractors. And then we had to respond because it was in a scientific journal. So we wrote this giant paper. Doron Behar, my PhD student, former PhD student, worked very, very hard and showed, refuted everything about that. And it's clearly, there is no Khazar. No one knows who the Khazars are. No one knows the descendants are. So we went and tested anyone who might be a descendant. So we didn't test Japanese. We didn't test Inuit. But anybody, Armenia, the Caucasus, we took every single population that might have been a possible descendants of the Khazar and compared their DNA, did a giant study, and completely scientifically refuted any remnant. And it's gone. So if you are asked that question, you can just send them to this scientific paper published in a real scientific journal. But just going back, what do we see about the Y chromosome, the men of Ashkenazi Jews? So the Y chromosome, we see that they are not, they're closest to what other, this is kind of a plot which shows how close the markers are as a group to other markers. They're close to Syrian Arabs, Palestinian Arabs, Kurds, and not that close to the Y chromosomes of non-Jewish Europeans. So, and not to sub-Saharan Africans, other than the Lemba. That was a paper from with Mike Hammer. Now, there are some exceptions. This is a different way of looking at the same data, where you can see these branches have names, the names are arbitrary, and most Jews, Jewish male Y chromosomes, fall on these branches that are called J, J2, etc. They're very typical Near Eastern. They're not very much Eurasian or European. There are two exceptions, and I'm just showing you one. One is the Ashkenazi Levites, a really, really, really interesting story. We've written three papers now together with Doron Behar about, because they are an outlier, unexpected outlier completely. Again, you test a hypothesis, you have to show the data, and then try to explain it. And it turns out that there is a large group of European Jewish Levites who are descendants of one man. And the final word on that is in this paper, which appeared relatively recently, the genetic variation, it's called the R1A branch. It is from the Near East. It's shown here as Eurasia. It's actually one of the exceptions. It's an R1A from the Near East, and it comes from the Horowitz. The original man was a Ish Horowitze. Okay, I've talked enough about the Y chromosome. I might come back to it. And you've seen, some of you have seen this. Half the world's population does much better without the Y chromosome, right? They're here. And if you ask them, you know, what is the Y chromosome good for anyway, right? It doesn't have much going for it, actually. Right? Raptors, things like that. Those are good for marking, but doesn't really do much. And we talked about our family. So this is an older picture, and this... These grandchildren are already 52 young ladies here, 15 already. But I keep this picture because I was trying to get these grandchildren to, you know, have an affinity for me, right? And what book was I reading? Are You My Mother, right? That book, right? Now, I couldn't find a Hebrew translation of that book. There is a similar story, but it's not the same. And they like me. You can see. This is Yafa. She's looking at me. And Noah, she's leaning against me. I don't know about Moria, and et cetera. But what are they really looking for? Looking for their mother, right? So we want to look at the mitochondrial DNA, because that's where we're interested. And the mitochondrial DNA also draws a tree, a maternal tree. That tree is rooted in Africa, because that's the origin of humanity. And we checked mitochondrial. This goes back a long way, but it's come back to help or haunt us. We'll get to that in a minute. We checked many, many mitochondrial DNA sequences of Jews and non-Jews from various regions of the world. As you can see, these are where the samples, thousands, now there's tens and tens of thousands of samples. And we found something that among Ashkenazi Jews, okay, but it's also, we also see it in non-Ashkenazi Jews to a different extent, that many, up to 40%, it's actually more, Ashkenazi Jews are the descendant of four women. Four women a few hundred years ago. And they fall onto these lineages defined by mitochondrial DNA sequence. That was published, it reached a lot of public attention, and it came back, and I'll come to how it came back to us. I ignored it. I almost didn't want to talk about it. There were other women, of course, but many of them didn't leave descendants that we see today. So these are the women who were more successful in terms of leaving descendants reproductively today. There are other founding lineages, they're just not as big. So there's 1.5 million or 2 million people who have the same mitochondrial DNA from one woman. And you don't see them among European non-Jews, because we've looked. So these are what are called the major founding maternal lineages, and there are minor founding lineages, and they come from the Near East. I won't go through, there was a scientific debate that maybe these originate in Europe from women who converted to Judaism, okay? But we found that they originate in the Near East. They may have converted, they may not have converted, we don't know, but they come from the Near East. And after we published this in 2006, Amy Harmon from the New York Times contacted me, and she said, I want to know if I'm the descendant of one of these women. It's really important to me. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't help you because we work under an institutional review board ethics. I have to de-identify every single sample. If you want to really know, there are companies. You can pay them money, send in your name, et cetera, et cetera. I have zero commercial interest in any of this. And she did. And she found out she was, had this K2A2A, and then she wrote this article in New York Times. She was all happy. I said, congratulations, but it doesn't make a hoot of difference, actually. But if it makes you happy, that's great. And it makes the company happy, that's even better. Okay, so, and it's fine. I'm not against it. I think it's fine. People should have autonomy to do and learn as much as they want about themselves. That's my view. But we do see something from these small numbers of Y chromosome and mitochondrial lineages in the Ashkenazi population. And by the way, we find founding lineages like this in the Gruzini population, in the Moroccan population. It just didn't, after we published this Ashkenazi, then we published another paper called Counting the Founders. We went through all of the communities, it just didn't get as much attention, that's all. But they're there. If you want to see, if you're from another community, you want to see, am I a member of one of the founding lineages from Tunisia, you can look in this paper about 2 years later. But there's this, what's called a bottleneck effect. So if you have, a lot of colors in a bottle, and then you take out a small sample, you reduce the diversity. And so how does this manifest to physicians? To physicians and geneticists, if you take a disease like cystic fibrosis, now there's more than 2,000 mutations in the cystic fibrosis gene that are known, among Ashkenazi Jews, or cystic fibrosis even rarer in other communities, you only find 6 mutations which cover all of, or 95% of Ashkenazi, of cystic fibrosis, or only 1 or 2 in other founded, bottlenecked communities, because there's a reduction in diversity that occurs in population. There are actually a number of bottlenecks in Jewish history. First of all, more than 3,000 years ago, there were people here, not here, there were people here too, but there were people in Israel, right? There were people there. And they weren't yet Jewish or Muslim or Christian or Druze or Baha'i, or they were people. And they were in Iraq, of course, and they were wandering around. And we share, Jews and non-Jews share mutations, and this is one of them which predisposes to Parkinson's disease, which is found among Arabs and Jews. Then there are bottlenecks, and this is not found, these mutations are not found in China or Sweden, okay? Then there are these areas which are shared between non-Ashkenazi and Ashkenazi Jews that go back before the split, like the Y chromosomes. And then there are these mutations that arose after the establishment of the Ashkenazi or European community. If we look at how the BRCA mutations were found, so Mary Claire King has won many, many awards this year. She just won the Dan David Prize at Tel Aviv University. I spent some time with her. She did the work that led to the discovery of the BRCA gene and the testing and has saved many lives. She got the Rambam Award a few years ago. She comes to Israel about 3 or 4 times a year from University of Washington in Seattle. A wonderful, wonderful scientist and woman. And through her, she studied Ashkenazi Jewish families where there was a high percentage of breast or ovarian cancer. discovered, did the work that Myriad Genetics then discovered the gene, but it's her work, and she deserves the prize. But then you look and you see that there are areas of the world of practicing Catholics who have the same mutation. Why is that? Why should they have that? Okay, and of course, through her work, you know, many other mutations that are not the founding Ashkenazi ones are found in other women from many different ancestries, such as Angelina Jolie. And we now know that Rosalind Franklin carried one of these Ashkenazi founding mutations, and she succumbed to breast and ovarian cancer. How do we know that? We know that from Mary Claire King, who has studied her descendants and family members, so and traced back to her. And that's public knowledge again. But how do these people in the San Luis Valley and other places get the kind of DNA that's typical of people from the ancient kingdom of Judea who moved around southern Europe? So what about the Spanish expulsion contribution? So we know what happened, the tragedy of around 400,000 estimated people in the Iberian Peninsula, around 240,000 converted to Catholicism under duress, and about 160,000, you know, the inquisitors kept records. They kept detailed records, and they pursued people far and wide. And those who left to various places. Some went to Holland, of course, but mostly Bulgaria, the community of Saloniki, which was utterly destroyed during the Second World War by the Nazis and their partners, and Bulgaria and Turkey. And conversos, so I left some Hebrew on here, I'm sorry, went to the Americas. Now, we went into Spain, we being a collaboration with Dr. Jobling of Leicester University, Doran Behar and I, and sampled current residents of the Iberian Peninsula, practicing Catholics. And they have, 20% have Y chromosomes of Jewish ancestry, and then after we did that, here they are, they're different, more in Portugal than in Spain. And then same work was done subsequently by others on mitochondrial DNA, and a very, very interesting, I think, an important event occurred among the Chueta of Mallorca. There are founding lineages, for those of you who've visited, in parts of northern Portugal, in Belmonte and Braganza. But this is the island of Mallorca, where the Chueta were not welcome into the general community, so they didn't really have much movement. And without DNA, both the Spanish government and the Israeli rabbinate and minister of the interior designated the Chueta as Jewish halachically and legally in 2011, just by their story, their history, and their genealogic lineages, and they celebrated that. So can we now figure everything out? So we have individuals who share the same set of markers for the Y chromosome, mitochondrial DNA. You can look at the whole genome. You couldn't in the past because it would cost $3 billion to sequence one genome in 2000, right? Now it costs about $800. So, and to just do markers cost $40 or something. So it's now the whole genome can be probed. And we're among the first people to do that and published it. And we examined 14 diaspora Jewish and more than 60 non-Jewish communities and checked their whole genomes from different parts of the world. And then did this fancy kind of, I can't do it. I work with mathematicians. Somebody asked me before from the Kelman family, who does the math? Who does all the statistics? You know, I can barely understand it when they explain it to me, but I insist on understanding it. And this is researchers from 8 countries. We published this called The Genome-Wide Structure of the Jewish People based on all of this work. Shai Tsur, this is Doron with Richard Willems from the Estonian BioCenter. Most of the investigators are not Jewish. And when we analyzed this, we found the following. And around the same time, Harry Osterer and a group of investigators independently, different samples, completely independently, came up with the same finding and published it during the same week without us, you know, knowing anything about this. Jews from communities covering more than 90% of the contemporary Jewish population of the world cluster together with each other. Here they are, tiny cluster, with some outliers. And they're closest to which other people? Levant populations. The Levant being Syria, modern Israel, parts of Jordan, Cyprus, Lebanon. And that's where the clustering is. This is that paper I was telling you, no evidence from genome-wide data of a Khazar origin for Ashkenazi Jews. And contemporary Ashkenazi Jews, I'm going to them from the genome-wide work, and this is the work of Shai Carmi, who is now, he was in at Columbia for many years, he now is in Yerushalayim at Hebrew University, did brilliant work, full sequencing, and is able to kind of pinpoint and shows that European Jews, genome-wide, are about 50% Levant, on average. I'm not saying any one individual could be different. And about 50% of genomic markers typical of Southern Europe. And if you go and look at the history books, so I'll get to this in a minute. So what do we see as an overall pattern? We see a past history of the Jewish people that traces to the Levant, but has been dispersed. And there are global genomic and cultural influences. That's why we see diversity in the Jewish people today. And now they come back. This diversity comes from many reasons. We adopt other cultures, other melodies, etc. We retain the ancient tradition. There's introgression, conversion, admixture, other evolutionary adaptions. So are we a mosaic as a people, or I like the word that Harry Oster uses, a tapestry. I like tapestry better, even though there's now a project in Israel called the Israel Mosaic Project, which I'm involved in, where we're going to sequence everybody in Israel, Jews and non-Jews, and put all, just like all of us, or Genome Canada, the government just about 2 months ago announced funding for it. And the tapestry, because you see the strings of ancient origin. Now, genetics tells us that there is shared Jewish ancestry throughout the globe, but finding lost Jews, in my view anyway, now I'm getting a little bit non-scientific, okay? Is that all right for a minute? Extends, in my view, beyond genetics. So we looked at the communities of India, the Bene Israel, the Kuchin, the Bene Menashe, ancient Torah scrolls. To me, seeing that, and this was done in the 50s or 60s, when Jews came from all parts of the world back to Israel, and they brought with them Torah scrolls, and there were comparisons made, right? I think many of you know this work. The words were almost identical. There were one or two changes here and there in some communities, very little. Now, to me, that's much more remarkable than DNA, right? Because we don't really have much power over what DNA we drag along and schlep along here and there, right? But to be in India and in Morocco and Lithuania with no WhatsApp and no SMS and no nothing and maintain the same letters over centuries so far apart is unheard of. That, to me, is much more miragesh, as they say in Hebrew, right? Much more emotional than, you know, finding stuff which is pretty obvious. And then when we see the Bnei Menashe in a village in northeastern India, now, this isn't, where is this from? Anyone know? Anyone guess now? This is from Kaifeng, okay? The Kaifeng Jewish community. And this is some research we did on the Kaifeng Jewish community. This is right beside my lab. This is the conference room beside my lab in the Faculty of Medicine right beside Rambam with my students, Shai Tsur, Yaron Granot, and others, and visitors from China. This man is not a visitor from China, by the way. He is the brother of now the now somewhat in trouble commander of the Israeli Navy who has both Chinese and Jewish ancestry. But he was, anyway, he worked with us. He helped us a lot getting this DNA, but we don't have the DNA in Israel. We have the results of the DNA in Israel. Why don't we have the DNA in Israel? I was in China, I think I have a picture. I'll just show you a couple pictures and I'll tell you the story. So this is the community of Kaifeng. They've come to Israel, some of them. This is in Yamin Ord. This is the husband of one of my students who's hosting them, and they're now Israeli citizens, and they've converted to Judaism. I went to China, and here I am in Nau Island. Nau Island is off the South China Sea, and at the time, Kaifeng, as you know, was the capital of China. It was the place where, if you were a merchant on the Silk Route, you'd go to Kaifeng, not to Beijing or Shanghai, and that's where Jewish traders went. And when the Song Dynasty fell, the Song leaders and their Jewish courtiers fled to Nau Island. So I went and visited there and was very, very nicely greeted. But I was going to take DNA. I was going to say, you know, I'll take DNA out of China. What's the big deal? I was told the following two interesting stories before going. I met with someone who had lived in Kaifeng and spent some time there, and he said, listen, when you go and you collect the DNA, there's seven families. Two have the same surname, the I family, and a few other families. I think their names appeared on the picture from many years ago. He said, go to the I family first, then go to the Xi family. Don't tell the Xi family that you're the I family, because they won't cooperate with you. I said, I don't need to go. They're obviously Jewish, right? Just from what you're telling me about how to collect the DNA. And then I said, but you know, we'll collect the DNA anyway. They said, wait a minute. Be careful about collecting the DNA. I said, why? Because taking DNA of Chinese nationals out of China is a crime. I said, okay, it'll be in my pocket. I'll pay a fine. No. It's a crime. What crime is it? Espionage. Do you know what the punishment for espionage is in China? It's pretty severe. I wouldn't be talking to you today. So I decided we're not going to take the DNA. We cooperated with these Chinese scientists, and they did all the analysis in China, sent us the results, which they shouldn't have. And I will tell you something. The Chinese, we have not published this because the Chinese government forbade them. We have the data. And five out of the seven families have clear Near East ancestry. We can't publish it. And the reason we can't publish is I don't want to get our Chinese collaborators in trouble. We publish it, they will lose their jobs. They will probably not be killed, but they will go hungry. So we're waiting until it's all written and, you know, put it in a time capsule, but we can't publish it. What about the future? Okay, I'm near the end. So there's a saying attributed to Yogi Berra, but it's not for, he took it from someone else. You know, it's risky to make predictions, especially about the future, right? So I'm going to be really careful here. I'm going to talk about a couple of trends, okay? Three and then one more trend. Whoops, where are we here? Changing genomic structure in the Israeli Jewish community, the changing genomic structure in the U.S. Jewish community. Canada is quite different, I would say. And recovery of lost Jews from remote communities. What does the future tell us? Well, Israeli Jewish community, massive change. Here's my family. This is from my family, right? These grandchildren are not Ashkenazi, they're not Moroccan, they're not European, they're everything, right? Because our kids married, you know, some married Moroccan, some married this, all kinds. So it's all of these partitions don't exist. We're one Jewish people now in Israel. And our late Rav from our community, at every simcha used to come, he said, it's a very Israeli community, and he really was fond of the fact that we made Aliyah, and he said, this isn't kibbutz galuyot, this is mizug galuyot, this is the coming together of the diasporas, not of the intermingling of the diasporas, not just the, you know, side by side of the diasporas. So that's one example. There are many examples like this. That's the expression he used. What's happening in the U.S.? Well, there's a large egress of Jewish ancestry into the general population on the one hand, and then there's a growth of a few communities. That's what you see on the left, on my right, your left. And then you have growth of a few communities with very high levels of endogamy in Williamsburg and Crown Heights and so forth. And that might change the way American Jewish community looks two generations from now in certain ways. Now, is this the first time this has happened? No. I don't know if anyone recognizes these pictures, but Torah in Motion has a travel program. And I don't know if part of the travel has been to the catacombs of Rome. the Jewish catacombs. You've been there? Okay, so you might recognize this. Now, the Jewish catacombs of Rome, there are exposed Jewish remains. I don't know if you saw them, okay? Here is an example. This is a tooth from the Jewish catacombs of Rome. The pulp of the tooth has a lot of DNA. Are we allowed to extract that DNA? We had a huge discussion about this with Rav Usher Weiss and others. It's very, very loaded issue. There are Rabbanim here, so I won't pretend to say anything other than what I heard, that there are circumstances under which you're allowed, especially from teeth, especially if they're not attached to a body, to take a small amount of DNA, but I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to give up suck on that. That is ongoing work of real ancient DNA. This is 2,000 years ago. These catacombs are from 2,000 years ago. And we know that the Roman Empire, 5 to 10% of the citizens of the Roman Empire were practicing Jews. And they were taxed based on their practice of Judaism or not for a period of time. So it's not new that Judaism has accepted people into the community. People have left the community. This is not new. Now, if you, recently this was shown, the Ministry of the Diaspora in Israel said, you know, we read history. The total number of Jews that ever lived from the beginning of Abraham or Mount Sinai to this day, how many have there been altogether on the planet? Many. Unfortunately, many perished. Many were lost for many reasons. So there should be a lot of people today who have Jewish ancestry, who have some time, 500 years ago, 900 years ago, 400 years ago, Jewish ancestry. Can you estimate that? Well, you can estimate it on history books. You can estimate it by sampling DNA. You won't find much in Japan, but you'll find a lot in Europe. We found a lot in Iberia, Spain, and Portugal. You find a lot. And the question is this important? There are a couple of philanthropists in the United States who have sponsored huge successful programs, so I won't, you can guess who some of them are, who are interested in subsidizing this testing. They say, look, let people find out if they have Jewish ancestry. Why? Because maybe they'll have a greater affinity to the Jewish people, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Michael Freund, Shavei Yisrael, I think is doing what's called Avodat Kodesh, right, sacred work in trying to find so-called lost Jews. And when we say lost Jews, I'm not talking about the 10 lost tribes, which is a whole other story. And it's a big question. So that's called the recovery of lost Jews. I do want to say that we have to put this in the context of the genetic future of all of humankind. I've talked about Jews, but what's happening to our future as human beings? You know, the big, major finding came right beside Haifa, the Carmel. Though it had been the Carmel, there's burial graves of Neanderthals, modern humans, etc. And the earliest skeletons of modern humans were found right near Rambam Hospital up in the Carmel, published in January. So outside of Africa, the first way station for people to go all over the world passed through northern Israel. Maybe also Yerushalayim, maybe the Negev, but the evidence is in northern Israel, right where we live. What about the future? Under the radar screen in 2010, Craig Venter made the first synthetic cell, synthetic genome. Same year, also, this all happens in California, right? Someone made DNA with 6 instead of 4 letters. 6. Not 4 letters, 6 letters. So that's a whole new life form. What can we expect in terms of the future of humankind with our ability to edit our genomes, intervene? So Darwin, you know, evolution, random mutation, natural selection. He was right in observing nature, but we've intervened. Now, we are partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We believe as part of our Jewish tradition, but we have to do it right, and we have to keep our ethical senses about us. So when we consider Jewish identity, and this is a daily question in Israel, as you know, you read the news, open the Jewish Times, the Jerusalem Post, people are very, very emotional and correctly feel strongly. And there are many issues So here are these pictures, and you know, I use this expression which Gil Atzmon uses, another researcher, saw you at Sinai. We're Jewish if, you know, we were together at Sinai, one way or another. Either we convert to Judaism, we join the Jewish people, or we've born Jewish, or halakh, whatever. But there is more. There's epigenomics. Epigenetics, you've heard about it. So this is one of our daughters, Tova, at her MD graduation a number of years ago. She's now done pediatrics and genetics. And they let me put, you know, the cap and gown on her. This is her daughter a number of years ago reading chronic kidney disease chapter in the textbook of medicine. Is this nature, nurture, or epigenetics? What is it? So I think there is no less important is the cultural epigenome. And we know that Hillel and our sages knew that you don't have to be born a descendant of Aaron to love. You have to be born a descendant of Aaron to be a bona fide Kohen, right? But you don't have to be born a descendant of Aaron to acquire his attributes of loving peace and pursuing peace. These are some of the people I have the privilege of working with. We're on a visit to the Hula Valley looking. Lots of DNA extraction work. So thank you. This is a picture from the Carmel. And then I'm going to stop because we could go back to those cases, but I've taken up a lot of time. And you know what? You can guess some of the dilemmas with those cases. I'll stop here, and I'm happy to answer. I want to once again say what a privilege it is. I want to thank the Kelm and Gutenberg family. I want to thank all of you for welcoming me back.
Really, I want to thank you for really a beautiful presentation and your kind words, and the whole process of having you here has really been such a pleasure, and your interest in our family and in all the work you do, and it's really a pleasure to have you here, and I want to thank you, and we'll delve in Mariv in a few minutes. I had originally invited Dr. Skorecki to come to our medical ethics conference in the that we're doing in Syracuse, but he couldn't come, and this is really how this evening got started. He said, well, he can't come then, but he'll come now, but everybody's welcome to come to the medical ethics conference. This is a taste of what you get, but really I want to thank you and thank my sister and my brother, and we will also, in a few weeks, we're also doing a Shabbat program with Yael Ziegler, and we'll send you further details about that, and let's start with Mariv in a few minutes. I think it's late, but if there are any people who have questions privately, we'll be happy to take them. And thank you very much, Lila Tov.